Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck On Demand. I'm John Schaefer. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Later on our show today, the least essential albums of the year and the cool side of Yuletide. Our resident choir treats us to some classical and brand new holiday songs. But first, the classical music world had its share of high and low notes in 2006. Tower Records, the largest brick-and-mortar retailer for classical music, went belly up. Orchestras and opera houses got onto the multimedia bandwagon, cutting all sorts of deals for downloading, internet streaming, and satellite radio. And while beleaguered record labels were cutting back, there were some bright spots, like a new 10-CD box set of the Shostakovich Symphonies, which you're hearing in the background. Joining us with her highlights for 2006 is Anne Majette, classical music critic and a contributor to the New York Times. Anne, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Now, in February of this year, way back when, you wrote, "By conventional wisdom, classical music accounts for 3-4% of overall recording industry sales. But on Apple's iTunes, classical music represents 12% of sales." That's an astonishing figure.
I think it's wonderful. I think it represents the problem that bricks and mortar stores have with classical music, which is that the uninitiated walk in and don't really know what they want, with all of these bins in front of them, with all of these names they don't know. Whereas if you're looking on iTunes in the privacy of your living room, it's much easier to try something unfamiliar, and you're not committed to a whole CD. You can sample a track or two. So the people who are buying this music on iTunes are young people.
So this sort of unlooked-for confluence of this allegedly old-fashioned music and the newest media, and now, of course, the Met, the Metropolitan Opera, has gotten into multimedia in a huge way under their new director, Peter Gelb.
Well, the Metropolitan Opera was definitely one of the big stories of the year, and it also showed that it's not necessarily a question of changing the product as much as it is of changing the presentation. One of the things that puts young people off classical music is that it seems stuffy and elitist, and Peter Gelb, by opening the season with a live broadcast in Times Square, free to everybody, signaled a profound new change, but also put it on people's radar. And you read stories all the time of young people who were in Times Square who went straight out and bought a ticket to the Metropolitan Opera. And that can only be good for the field.
Now, with the rise in downloading of classical music and with classical music streaming on the web, and, you know, the Met's going to be doing operas in movie theaters and stuff, do you think this is a turnaround? Will these various little scenarios somehow come together and put more fannies in the seats, to use a George Steinbrenner term?
I think so. I think actually that classical music has been very slow to jump on the downloading bandwagon because of the musicians' contracts, which prohibit the sales of recordings through unconventional media. And a lot of those orchestras are now renegotiating those contracts, so they're finally able to get on the bandwagon as pop music was doing several years ago. Mm-hmm. There's no reason that classical music, like pop music, can't open up to a fan base who is able to download the concert they just heard on the web after hearing it. And with New York Philharmonic on iTunes, you're starting to see that.
So it's the Grateful Dead model.
It's the Grateful
Dead
model.
All these New York Philharmonic fans driving around in their little microvans. Now, we heard plenty this year about Mozart, 250th anniversary, somewhat overshadowing the 100th anniversary of poor Dmitri Shostakovich.
Although it looked to me like a lot of programs split down the middle. We had a lot of new Mozart recordings, but we had some magnificent new Shostakovich recordings, including the Maris Janssens box.
All right, now Maris Janssens, this guy has been overlooked in the classical music field, I feel, since his time in Oslo, where he took the Oslo Philharmonic and raised them to a level they had never been at before, came to this country, worked with Pittsburgh, now he's back in Europe, and this set is on your list of the best recordings.
The set is fantastic. I agree with you 100%. Janssens is not appreciated in this country. I think in Europe it's quite different. He's recognized as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, living conductor. I would make that claim for him, and I'm not given to hyperbole, but there's a deep sort of musicianship and clarity in his approach. And he came with the Bavarian Radio to New York this year, and really showed Carnegie Hall how wonderful he could be. I think those concerts helped put him on the map a little bit more here.
So this multi-year project of recording the complete Shostakovich symphonies, a success in your eyes and ears?
I think it's
ears.
A huge success. One of the hallmarks of it is that he worked with a number of different orchestras. He has many close relationships to a wide range of orchestras. And there are many different distinctive orchestral sounds coming to play, which helps enrich the picture a little bit.
Well, in this performance, the Symphony No. 7, it's the Leningrad Philharmonic, Maris Janssens and the music of Shostakovich. Shostakovich, Symphony No. 7. It was the centennial of Shostakovich's birth this year, and conductor Maris Janssens put together a box set of the complete Shostakovich symphonies, and we're speaking with Anne Majette of the New York Times about her picks for the best classical music of 2006. Worth mentioning again, at least four different orchestras on this set, so it's not the usual box where it's an orchestra and a conductor going through a whole cycle.
Absolutely, and in a way the orchestras are matched to the personality of the pieces. We just heard the Leningrad Symphony with the Leningrad Philharmonic, now called the St. Petersburg Philharmonic,
right.
Which has a real Russian sort of warmth and identification, whereas something like the Fourth, which is one of my favorites, is with the Bavarian Radio, which is just a powerhouse. It's like the BMW of orchestras.
Now, there are several living composers on your list of the best classical music of 2006. Let's start with John Adams and the Dharma at Big Sur. How did he make this work? A concerto for an electric violin and orchestra?
It's fabulous. I say that it's California classical. It sounds kind of like a pop song and kind of like a fabulous orchestral piece, sort of like Debussy's La Mer gets to California.
It was written for Tracy Silverman, who for a brief time was a member of the Turtle Island String Quartet. So a guy who has a background in jazz and pop and improvising music.
Which was very deliberate. I mean, he wanted to play with the different kinds of sounds and maybe the things that happen. I think he said the things that happen in between the notes of classical music, all of the effects that are part and parcel of many other traditions, from classical Indian music to jazz to pop. And I believe Tracy Silverman plays a six-string electric violin on this.
Yeah, it's five or six. It's got at least one extra string. And, of course, Adams is a guy who's done his share of electronic music, so he's
absolutely
familiar with the medium.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful synthesis of that electronic sound with a really intelligent and ever-growing ability with the orchestra that he has.
Well, let's hear a little bit. The Dharma at Big Sur. This is the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer John Adams.
Thank you.
John Adams is the composer. He wrote The Dharma at Big Sur for the opening of Disney Hall in L.A., and he wrote it for the six-string electric violin that Tracy Silverman is playing in the background. Adams conducts the BBC Symphony in this recording, which made it onto Anne Majette's list of the best classical music of 2006. She's classical music critic and contributor to the New York Times and joins us occasionally on Soundcheck as well. And Adams sort of came to the fore here in America as a kind of second-generation minimalist after Steve Reich, Philip Glass. He's moved well beyond that. That influence can still be heard here and there.
You can hear the influence, but the kind of richness has evolved to such a degree that minimalism is only a term for the repetitions that sometimes happen. But
right.
There's such a denseness and texture and wonderful things that happen in the music that minimalism no longer really applies.
Well, I think you could say much the same thing about the next composer on your list, and that's the Dutchman Louis Andriessen, who, you know, also came of musical age in the 1970s and had a very distinctive and very personal take on American jazz and minimalism.
Absolutely.
Things like that.
Absolutely. And is a bit of a maverick in Europe for that. Although Andriessen is a bit more of an éminence grise. I think he's a bit older than Adams. And he's certainly in the Netherlands the leading Dutch composer and has done a number of major operatic collaborations with Peter Greenaway. One could say that John Adams has done a number with Peter Sellers, cognate. But writing to Vermeer is a bit of a departure from some of the more violent pieces like Rosa or De Materie. It's a much more delicate, it evokes the sound world of Vermeer's time. The conceit is that these are letters being written to Vermeer by the women in his life, and he has a very sort of thin, translucent sound and beautiful writing for voices. And it's really a wonderful synthesis that you might even call a late work with that sort of sensibility to it.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Vermeer has sort of been attractive to composers for centuries. And you wonder at some point, what new is there for a composer to say? And Andriessen finds something, a very fresh take on Vermeer as a kind of a family man as opposed to the great artist.
Well, Vermeer seen through the women in his life who are definitely not very well documented.
Mm-hmm.
It was also notable that I think this recording works better orally than it did visually on the stage. It got so confused with all these things going on, and it's quite a delicate piece with a lot happening. You want to just be able to hear it.
All right, and you could hear it in this recording that features the Schoenberg Ensemble and the Asco Ensemble, conducted by Reinbert de Leo. It's music by Louis Andriessen. The opera is called Writing to Vermeer, and it's by the Dutchman Louis Andriessen. Basically, letters to Vermeer, ostensibly letters from his wife, his daughter, and his favorite model, I think
his mother-in-law.
His mother-in-law, okay.
Right.
And his favorite model. So Anne Majette from the New York Times with her picks for the best classical music of 2006, and we find Louis Andriessen there. John Adams, Dmitri Shostakovich, so 21st and 20th century music well represented. But also, it seems like this year, looking at your list, was a good year for tribute CDs to you know, artists of bygone eras. You know, some great Wagnerians get a shout-out on your list. Steve Reich, of course, big 70th birthday celebration.
Well, I included Steve Reich and also Martin Bresnik on my list as sort of best CDs slash events, because in each case they celebrated a big birthday that was major. I mean, the Steve Reich at 70 Festival was a fantastic New York-wide celebration, an unprecedented collaboration between the three leading halls in New York. And really, showed once again what a fantastic composer he is, mm-hmm. With new work as well as old work. And the new box set, of course, Nonesuch did a sort of definitive box set some years ago with 10 CDs. The new set is 5 CDs. It does have the UR variations, which the earlier set didn't have. And it's also, as Bob Hurwitz of Nonesuch said, a possibly more affordable compendium mm-hmm. of Reich for people who are just coming to him.
The late Luciano Berio, a collection of his sequenzas, his various solo pieces for different instruments. And then there is, it's not quite a tribute album, but we can treat it as such. Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, the great mezzo-soprano who passed away this summer. This is her musical farewell, a series of poems by Pablo Neruda set by her husband, the noted composer Peter Lieberson. How do you even begin to, how could you write about this, you know, with critically, not being overcome with all the emotion that's associated with this final piece?
Well, thank goodness I didn't have to, because when I put it in the CD player, I began to cry. So, but it's a phenomenal set of love songs. They're wonderfully written, and they're beautifully written for the voice. And, of course, the emotional impact of hearing her sing these in her final public appearance. She just died a mere seven months after they were recorded, I believe. Mm-hmm. They're a really powerful piece, even without that extra wallop.
Right. But, so this recording is the actual premiere performances that she gave with the Boston Symphony.
Yes, it's a live recording. And it's also James Levine's first recording with the Boston Symphony, which is almost parenthetical given the emotional wallop of it.
Yeah. But, now, she had basically canceled everything else for that season, just did these songs.
Yes.
And the final song, you talk about an emotional wallop. The Pablo Neruda text is basically the poet saying to his lover, don't weep for me, don't mourn for me when I'm gone.
It begins by saying, if I die and you do not, if you die and I do not, let us not make a great thing out of this. Let us not grieve so terribly. And, of course, that's exactly what happened.
Lorraine Hunt Lieberson singing the music written for her by her husband, Peter Lieberson. The late, great mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, who passed away earlier this year, and her final performances were the world premiere performances of these Neruda songs written for her by her husband, Peter Lieberson. We're speaking with Anne Majette, talking about some of her picks for the best classical music of 2006. Anne's complete list is on the soundcheck page of our website at wnyc.org, along with all the other critics that have joined us this week, and my list, and our listener list, and Wagner fans. It was good year for Wagner fans. I mean, there was you mentioned in your list a tribute to Thomas Stewart and Evelyn Lear, two great Wagner singers. But then there was also this Ring cycle that kind of materialized out of the mists of time and legend almost. Tell us the story.
It was the first ever stereo recording of Wagner's Ring, and it was made in 1955 at the Bayreuth Festival for Decca. But because of contractual issues, it wasn't released immediately. And then, of course, Sir Georg Scholti came along with his plan for a definitive studio recording of the Ring. And those plans sort of eclipsed the other plans, which were in any case, a little bit on hold. And so the thing just sat there for 50 years until it was re-released, or released for the first time ever, on Testament this year, beginning with Siegfried. And it's a remarkable alternative view. I mean, the Scholti Ring has become so definitive that that's our idea of what the Ring sounded like back then. And to hear the live performance from Bayreuth with Kyle Bert, who's another wonderful and, in America, underrated conductor, who you can hear on these recordings is a magnificent, consummate Wagnerian. The conducting alone is the strength of the whole set. Götterdämmerung has yet to be released, but out now are Rheingold, Walküre, and Siegfried.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Siegfried. So 3/4 of the Ring cycle has been released on Testament, and Josef Keilbert is the conductor of the Bayreuth Festival Orchestra. etc. for another 4 hours.
Oh, we're almost at the end by now.
Siegfried by Wagner from the 1955, a legendary recording made in Bayreuth, the temple that Wagner built to himself and his operas, which was never released until this year. It's made it onto Anne Majette's list of the best classical music of 2006. As I say, her complete list is on the soundcheck page of our website. All the other critic lists are there. My list is there, and we've been assembling a listener poll as well, and we've had a lot of people writing in, and so we've sort of tallied them up, and that list is on our page as well. And the runaway number one on our listener list is Andrea Bocelli. So I say to you, soundcheck listeners, ew.
Well, the best Bocelli anecdote is the business person who wrote it and said that she most admired Andrea Bocelli because she was deaf. Of course, Andrea Bocelli is a man and is blind. If I could just quickly interject, the singer was Astrid Varnai that we heard on the Siegfried.
In the Siegfried set with the Bayreuth Festival Orchestra. Well, Bocelli actually sang with the New York Phil, so, I mean, you know, he got some cred in the classical music world, I suppose.
Well, I believe the New York Phil wanted the ticket sales, which he brought with him. It was an uneasy marriage, possibly. I'm not sure that Bocelli's fans are interested in the New York Phil and vice versa.
All right. Well, here's a little bit for all you Bocelli fans. Besame mucho. And Anne Majette of the New York Times. Thanks so much for joining us again. Happy holidays.
Thank you for having me. You too.
Coming up, we've done the best of the year, time for some of the worst, and then later a live performance of some new Christmas music from the Young People's Radio Chorus.
Bésame, bésame mucho, como si fuera esta noche la última vez.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In a little while, a live performance of new music for Christmas from our resident choir, the WNYC Young People's Chorus, The Cool Side of Yuletide. But as you know, all this week we've been doing our review of the best of 06, and now we thought we might take a look at the uglier side of the year in music. We've invited Nathan Rabin, the music editor of the newspaper The Onion, to join us with some of The Onion's picks, what they call the least essential albums of the year. Nathan, what makes something least essential?
To answer your question, I think it's that it just has no reason whatsoever to exist. Like, these aren't necessarily the worst albums of the year, although they are the worst albums of the year. But, you know, I think just the fact that they, again, don't really have any reason to exist, yet exist all the same.
Okay.
Kind of the criterion for being included.
So there are other bad albums out there, but they're misfires, and in this case you wonder why somebody loaded the gun to begin with.
Oh, totally. Yeah, okay. Yeah, very much so. There's
right.
Just something kind of fundamentally askew about all of these projects.
Well, now, your number one least essential album of 2006 was...
is a closely guarded mystery. And I'm totally not able to tell you anything about it, especially whether or not it was by somebody who sired children by Britney Spears.
Okay.
You are so not going to get that out of me, no matter how much you prod.
All right. Well,
I will not tell you whether, you know, somebody has a hyphen in their name or subject to a lot of late night jokes.
It's bad enough that we had to deal with, you know, Kevin Federline as the ex Mr. Britney Spears. Now we have to deal with him as a rapper?
Well, that's
named,
I mean,
K-Fed?
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, that's the thing that's kind of interesting about doing Least Essential every year, is you see all of these projects and you think, well, God, that looks ridiculous. But there's kind of no way in which it could actually be as bad as it looks. And I actually listened to K-Fed's album this morning. K-Fed's totally playing with fire. Very incendiary and provocative message. And it really is just as jaw-droppingly awful as you would imagine. Sort of K-Fed's basic message can be kind of summed up as, I'm married to Britney Spears and you're not, and I'm spending all of Britney Spears' money and you're not. Not the most compelling message in the world. You're not exactly blowing in the wind or anything. And,
right.
And, like, even that.
Very small, you know, target audience, I would think, for that.
Very much so. And it's also just, like, the historical irony. It's just kind of, it's impossible to ignore.
Well, let's not ignore it. Let's hear some of it. K-Fed's album, Playing With Fire. Lifestyle of rich living in fast cars. Don't hate cause I'm a superstar. And I married a superstar. Never come between us no matter who you are. Come on, that's right, just get it. Let you feel it, make you lose control. This is that hip hop flavor mixed with a little bit of rock and roll. Valet your wig, grab your chair. You know how. Okay, K-Fed.
And the production is not bad, but no. Oh my God, like, yeah.
The lyrics.
Oh, totally. Well, I think his handler should say, you know, find another hobby. You know, maybe you can design handbags. That's what all the useless celebrities are doing. Although I guess he already had his own reality show, and that didn't turn out so well, so.
We're speaking with Nathan Rabin. He's music editor of the newspaper The Onion, joining us from Chicago with the least essential albums of the year. Your least essential Christmas album from a hoarse-voiced gangsta mediocrity is Dipset Christmas by Jim
yes.
Jones. Nathan, are you suggesting that gangsta rap just doesn't have the Christmas spirit?
Well, the funny thing about that, actually, is that back in the day, a cuddly, Yuletide-friendly label called Death Row put out a Christmas album. And, you know, despite boasting tidings of good cheer from people like Snoop Dogg and the Dog Pound, somehow failed to become a Christmas perennial. And Dipset Christmas is even worse. And the thing that's kind of interesting about it, it's 10 songs, five of which are basically gangster rap songs that have clumsy references to Christmas littered throughout, and then the next five songs have nothing whatsoever to do with the birth of the infant Messiah. So it is Dipset, and it is kind of Christmassy, but other than that, not a whole lot to recommend it. But there's also a pretty astonishing amount of profanity and drug references for a Christmas album ostensibly for children.
If Every Day Was Christmas is the name of this modern carol. From Jim Jones. Jim Jones, If Every Day Was Christmas. Lots of words spliced in backwards there.
Yeah, well, that's the hallmark of every Christmas classic, is they have lots of words bleeped out.
Okay, we are we're wasting some time with Nathan Rabin, music editor of The Onion, who's got The Onion's picks for what they call the least essential albums of the year.
Indeed.
And the staff's full list of picks is on the soundcheck page of our website at WNYC.org. Nathan, earlier this week, Ann Powers of the LA Times told us that, you know, in her list of the best music of the year, that it was a really good year for kids' music. You guys also gave a nod to kids' music with your least essential ego stroke perpetuated for the children.
Well, that's one of the things that's kind of fun about doing least essential every year is there is just sort of themes that sort of pop up all over the place. And one of them is sort of albums made by celebrities. that really have no reason to exist beyond the fact that celebrities were involved. So this one certainly fits that bill. It features such noted songsmiths as that woman from My Big Fat Greek Wedding. And let's see, John Stamos. You can't have a children's album without John Stamos. Xena the Princess Warrior. She totally has a song on there, and they're butchering the classics. I think that's kind of the theme of Unexpected Dreams, Songs from the Stars.
Well, here is Xena herself, Lucy Lawless, singing Little Child from the album Unexpected Dreams.
Celebrating your very first day on earth. Perfect hands, perfect feet, and those soft rosy cheeks. All my life I have dreamed of you, my sweet little child.
Nathan, I'm losing the will to live. Help me,
painful.
Nathan.
Oh, my ears are bleeding.
All right, we're talking about some of the least essential albums of the year. Now, again, not to say these are the worst musical albums, although I would be really afraid to hear what you've got that's worse than these records.
Yeah, they're kind of double as many of the worst albums of the year.
All right, now 2006 was the 10th anniversary of the death of Tupac Shakur.
Yes, that it was.
You picked a least essential Tupac-sploitation album called Pac's Life. Now, look, there have been many posthumous Tupac releases.
There have been.
What is the particular problem with this one?
Well, the thing, and I actually say this in the piece itself, is that it's actually one of the less inessential Tupac albums. There are two that very much stand, or three actually, that very much stand out in my mind as being more glaringly inessential. One of which is there were two separate albums inspired by Tupac's poetry.
Mm.
It's one thing to, you know, take the guy's freestyles and, like, make some new beats over them. It's another thing to, like, some really bad, you know, things that he scrawled about his feelings when he was in seventh grade and you know, make a song or a poem about it. And then the other was a remix collection called New Mix Classics. That is, of course, mix spelled with two X's.
With X's,
and
yes.
Classics with two Z's. And that was just basically a bunch of no-name death row producers remixing his songs. And this is, I mean, it's not terrible, you know, but it
but
is
it's
pretty,
not essential, is what you're saying.
It's grinding. It's also, it's like his 17th posthumous album.
Right.
You know, I think they're running out of stuff to recycle. I think his next album is going to be a bunch of voicemail messages from Tupac, like, yo, this is Tupac, I'm not home, leave me a message. There will be like 17 different remixes of that. They're scraping the bottom of the barrel dry. And there are like there are three remixes and only 13 tracks total.
Mm.
So six of the 13 songs have two different versions. So that's kind of a pretty good... Also, just, nothing that's kind of strange about it is that I got a Tupac collaborating with a lot of people who didn't become successful until 8 or 9 years after Tupac died.
Right.
So it's like they're, you know, collaborating with a historical figure, you know, like Abraham Lincoln or Jesus, as opposed to like a contemporary rapper.
All right, well, let's hear the little bit of the title track from this effort called Pac's Life.
21st, thought I'd be locked down, cracked out or in the dirt. And though it hurts to see the change, it comes with the fame. Watch for gossip and the silly game. So all the speaking down on me, this is the night. Why is everybody caught up in Pac's life? To all y'all conversating on my life, mind your business.
Pac's life.
Everybody needs to chill.
Everybody talk about Pac's life. What do you know about Pac's life? Now, what do you know? Everybody talk about Pac's life.
I remember that. Hello.
That is the title track from the posthumous Tupac release from this year called Pac's Life. And once again, we're talking with Nathan Rabin of The Onion and talking about some of the staff picks of the least essential albums of the year. And the full list on the soundcheck page of our website, WNYC.org. The article that unveils the complete list begins with this sentence: every year produces great music and a nearly equal amount of terrible music. Nathan, that seems awfully charitable.
Yeah.
And it's not very becoming, I'm afraid.
I would say that, yeah, that sort of the terrible music far outdistances the amount of good music that gets made.
It seems that way, and especially
more at the
for some reason right now.
Yeah.
There was an old favorite that allegedly reunited in 2006, and that is the band The Cars. You refer to this as your least essential reunion. Why?
Right. Well, the only thing sadder than kind of a cash-in quickie reunion from kind of past their prime players is a fake quickie cash-in reunion. So the new Cars, kind of the new is kind of a giveaway there. They don't feature this guy who is kind of dragging the Cars down, Rick Ocasek.
Yeah, right, the singer, the songwriter, right.
So great, yeah. Just because he wrote the songs and sang them and, you know, was a leader of the band. So the really sad thing is, you know, they replaced him with Todd Rundgren.
Yeah.
And Todd Rundgren, yeah, pretty auspicious musician in his own
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of hard to imagine what could have possibly gotten him to, you know, pull out his best Rick Ocasek impersonation. And actually, if you watch the Colbert Report, Rick Ocasek was on there. And
yes,
he
he's been
Todd
on, he's played
on
a
notice for fronting the new car. So it's a... He's on our least essential, and he's also on notice. So, probably ashamed to show his face in public these days.
Yeah, well, maybe not.
Yes.
But let's hear a little bit from the new Cars, and
ooh,
their
let's.
And the 2006 record called "It's Alive." Okay, so the new Cars. Nathan, would it be fair to say that maybe this record wouldn't have bothered you if it had been attributed to, you know, the new guys, you know?
Some dudes playing car songs?
Right, right.
I think that's part of it, you know? But again, you know, even under the best of circumstances, I can't really see how an album like this would have any reason to exist.
Mm-hmm. The album is called It's Alive. What about, I mean, we've been talking, I know your beat is mostly, you know, hip-hop, pop kind of stuff, know, the full Onion list of the least essential albums of the year covers a lot of genres. What about the year in crossover music? Do you have a least essential album by Juilliard-trained street violinists called Nuttin' But Strings?
Yeah, and as I sort of say in the piece, and I'm very fond of quoting myself, because I love my writing. But, you know, some people kind of, you know, were born into being inessential, and others kind of have an essentiality thrust onto them. And some people just come about inessentiality by having a really, really stupid name, and an even stupider gimmick. And as you might imagine, the Nuttin' But Strings falls into that third category. And the thing that's really sad is you'd imagine if you're going to call yourself Nothing But Strings, then you'll consist of nothing but strings.
Right.
But there's a lot more than just strings on this album. There's, like, really, really bad R&B. There's really bad hip-hop. There are, like, skits. It's pretty, pretty painful.
The album bears the somewhat poetic title of Struggle from the Subway to the Charts.
Yeah, very inspirational.
How far up the charts did they get with this, I wonder? I wonder if they got out of the subway with this.
I don't know.
So
don't give up your day jobs.
So, making the list of The Onion's least essential albums of the year is the band Nuttin' But Strings. We've been speaking with Nathan Rabin, the music editor of The Onion. Nathan, I guess I'll say thanks because it's the polite thing to say. Really, a pleasure to have you with us on the show. Happy holidays, and... we'll look for more next year.
Glad to be here. It was a pleasure.
In a moment, the WNYC Resident Choir, our own Young People's Chorus, will perform new music for the Christmas season live in the studio, and we would like to hear from you. You can email us. Our email address is soundcheck@wnyc.org.
It may be hard, but we'll still find a way to get through it. It's time to come together, y'all.
Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Each day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Thanks.